VOX 1460. Va bene, io vi ringrazio. My friends, il programma Ciao goes on Saturday from 1 to 2. Please listen and let your kids listen to this beautiful program. I'll bring you Italy on a silver platter. Enjoy the program sulla WVOX 1460. Thank you very much and tune in Saturday from 1 to 2 p.m. Grazie.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Of that weather forecast for today, we start off with a little bit of cloud cover. Turns out partly sunny today with some scattered showers and thunderstorms, or highs in the middle 80s. For tonight, mostly cloudy, some scattered showers and thunderstorms, mainly for the evening or overnight, lows in the upper 60s. Friday, mostly sunny, middle 80s on north winds, clear at night, 60 to 65. Saturday, mostly sunny, near 80. Sunday, sunshine in the lower 80s. It'll be mostly sunny, lower 80s on Monday. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Police Commissioner Pat Carroll, Stella Hall, Judge Gail Rice, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
Why pay for radio when it's free right here?
It's the future right now.
All you got to do is
listen and love it.
VOX.
Good morning and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education, and culture, and chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, August 22nd, 2013, the 63rd day of summer. We have lost 2 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 33 minutes since last we met 2 weeks ago. The sun rose at 6:12 this morning. It will set at 7:43 this evening. We will have 13 hours and 31 minutes of daylight today. The moon rose at 8:24 this morning. It will set at 8 this evening. Whoops, I got that wrong. The moon will rise at 8:24 this evening, and it will set 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Sorry about that. Last night was the full moon, so still pretty full tonight. Enjoy it. Next full moon is on September 19th. Next high tides. Thank you, Kevin. We do have a tide table today in New Rochelle at 12:49 p.m. That's in about 2 hours and 15 minutes. In Yonkers at 11:13 p.m., actually 10:55 a.m., which is in just about 21 minutes. Okay. Dobbs Ferry, 11:23 a.m., Tarrytown, 11:39, Haverstraw, 12:05, and Peekskill, 12:18. Now a regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives at war. May they live on in all of our hearts. Well, here's a young Air Force flight lieutenant, Timothy G. Santos, Jr., age 29, actually died of pancreatic cancer. He's from Helena, Alabama. He was with the 501st Aviation Regiment. He died August 18th of pancreatic cancer. He did make it back to the States. He had been stationed and deployed in Kuwait City. He was in Fort Bliss, Texas, when he died. He was diagnosed on March 24th, so in July, August, it was just about 5 months, which is merciful, really. Okay. Then there was an incident where three soldiers were killed. Specialist Keith Aaron Grace, Jr., age 26, of Baytown, Texas, Screaming Eagle, all three of them. He was with the 101st Airborne. They were killed when they were attacked by indirect fire in Paktia Province, Afghanistan, August 11. The other two, also Screaming Eagles, were Sergeant James Avery Hicks, age 22, of Little Rock, Arkansas, and Staff Sergeant Octavio Herrera, 26, from Caldwell, Idaho. Okay. These four American servicemen were alive on the date of our last broadcast 2 weeks ago. Each death is a great loss to his family and to all Americans. I look forward to the day when the war in Afghanistan and this feature come to an end, because there are no more deaths to report. Time for the Culture Corner. My reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions and you have the right to disagree with them because everyone has the right to be wrong. Well, last Friday we saw Oliver at the Westchester Broadway Theater. And I have the review right here. As usual with this particular theater, choreography prevails in Westchester Broadway Theater productions, even though this is not one of their own main stage productions. This is a different company. But they do have a large stage, and they really know how to use it. They know this, which explains their emphasis on great dancers, even when sometimes the acting and singing are quite, not quite up to par. But in this case, everything was quite good. And I should say in passing that this is not an Equity House, and so only one person in the whole company is an Equity player. Very interesting that they do a main stage production. Well, it's not a main stage, but they do a real full production at the Westchester Broadway Theater, and it's not an Equity House. Very interesting arrangement. In this production, as is often the case, there's one standout performance which elevates a production above the ordinary and makes the evening worthwhile. That performance is delivered here by John Anthony Lopez as Fagin. Mr. Lopez breathes life into Fagin, a rogue, but one you can appreciate for his sparkling personality. And Mr. Lopez is not a member of Actors Equity, which he should be. Brandon Singel carries off the Oliver Twist role with abilities which belie his 11 or 12 years. I gather his age because he starts the sixth grade in September. Quite a feat for Brandon. Some voice coaching will go far with this young man if he decides to pursue acting as a career. The fact that I highlight John and Brandon in no way detracts from some very fine performances by virtually the entire cast. If there was a weakness, I did not see it. Choreography, as previously mentioned, is great. The lighting program is well done, and the sets are better than average for this house. The usual comments about the sound system at WBT could be repeated yet again, but I'm not going to do that. Maybe someday they will upgrade. Until then, even if I miss some of the dialogue and lyrics, I enjoy the venue, the shows, and the dinners. A great evening out in Elmsford, right up the road from our studios. I highly recommend it. The cost is quite minimal. Parking is free. Dinner's included. Great service. Very friendly people. That's the Westchester Broadway Theater. This Oliver is playing now. And we'll keep you apprised of all of their productions as they come. Drew. My guest today is Daniel Bergner, author of a book called What Do Women Want? The subtitle is Adventures in the Science, mind you, of Female Desire. Need I say more? Okay, just a little bit more. Mr. Bergner has written three other books, and he's a regular contributor to respected publications such as the New York Times Magazine. How he got interested in the subject of the science of female desire has to be an interesting tale. Welcome, Daniel Bergner.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's nice to be talking with you.
Good morning. It's nice to have you on. So I really never thought that I would ask a man this question, but what do women want?
Well, first, I better say, especially since we're two men talking about this, I'm not here to offer, nor is the book, to offer a big capital T truth overarching, all-encompassing answer to that question. That would be awfully arrogant. But what I did starting 8 years ago is start spending a lot of time with scientists, most of them women, and then a lot of time interviewing individual women about their sexual lives, their sort of erotic psyches. And so I hope the book is filled with women's voices, women's answers to the question posed on the cover, what do women want?
Well, were women resistant to a man coming up to them and saying, I'd like to talk about your sex life? Did you have some credential? You say, I'm a doctor from Harvard, or I'm this or that. Did they just say, sure, I'll talk about my sex life with you?
Well, it's funny you should frame it that way. In truth, no. People weren't particularly resistant. You know, as a journalist, in a way, it's a rare project where one starts truly from a position of not knowing. Mostly, we start from a position of knowing a bit and then going out and you know, sort of substantiating or enriching, deepening what we know. Here, I really didn't know. So I asked all the more and listened with all the more sort of avidness and asked again. And different ways. And I think that in the end, people appreciate being listened to. People appreciate a sort of sincere attempt to sort through things, and that's what I was doing. So no, there wasn't resistance. And then, you know, to circle back again, I was writing about a lot of science that hadn't been written about, and that's really how the book got going.
So you actually did have a scientific perspective, but how did you approach these women? I mean, shall I just walk up to a woman in the street and say, hi, I'd like to discuss your sex life? I don't think I'd do very well that way.
Well, I suppose, first of all, important to make clear, this is the second book I've written about desire. So I was coming with some background. You know, I do write regularly for the New York Times Magazine, so I suppose that lends at least the semblance of credibility and seriousness. And, you know, I really was serious. So coming to it with, you know, this, the subject of sexuality should never be treated overly seriously, but coming to it with true sincerity. And, you know, again, 8 years ago, I walked into the lab of a woman, Meredith Tibbers, who was looking at female desire. She would later say to me, I, Meredith, feel I'm shaking the foundations of our beliefs about women's sexuality. That might sound kind of arrogant on her part. I think, in fact, it was quite accurate. And so partly the drive for me was just to follow her journey, to branch out to other researchers, and to look behind some cultural assumptions that I think have gotten in the way of understanding. So that's another answer to your question.
Okay.
I think the people I was talking to appreciated that attempt.
Okay. So now, I'm under certain perhaps their illusions that, for instance, a greater percentage of men can be seduced into infidelity than married women, let's say. Is that true?
Well, let's back up from what can happen in our world, which may be different from asking about desire itself. So if we think about desire itself, the old notion that men are programmed by evolution to spread their seed, to be promiscuous, and women, relatively speaking, to seek out one good man and to be fairly well-suited to monogamy, that is a myth.
Okay, Daniel, let me hold you there. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Daniel Bergner. You are listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in London, England, New London, Connecticut, Birmingham, England, Birmingham, Alabama, La Rochelle, or Paris, France, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live. I am Bob Lebensold. This is Environmentally Sound. My guest is Daniel Bergner, and we will be right back.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Pat O'Neill. The case of Nidal Hassan, admitted killer of 13 people in the 2009 Fort Hood massacre, expected to go to the jury today after final arguments.
After the closings, the judge will give the military jury their instructions about deliberating, which will include lesser charges they may consider if they feel prosecutors didn't prove premeditated murder or premeditated attempted murder.
Fox Radio's Evan Brown in Killeen, Texas. In Cairo today, supporters of former Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak celebrating as he's released from jail, taken by military helicopter to a hospital. Mubarak still faces retrial on charges related to the killing of hundreds of protesters in the 2011 uprising. A sign of an improving economy, the conference board's index of leading indicators, which previews future activity, grew 0.6% in June after no movement in May. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Stay connected to Fox News Radio for your favorite talk show, newscasts, on the hour and half hour, and the podcasts that take you a step deeper inside of Fox News. For the most compelling and quotable reporting and analysis on the big political stories of the day, you won't want to miss the All-Star Panel from Special Report with Brett Baer. You can hear Brett and his panelists, including Charles Krauthammer, Juan Williams, A.B. Stoddard, Steve Hayes, and others, break down the politics of the day like no one else. Subscribe now by going to foxnewsradio.com and clicking on the podcast button for the All-Star Panel from Special Report. And check out other Fox News Radio podcasts, including The Early Scoop with Fox News Radio's entertainment reporter Sabrina Sabah, with the latest in the world of entertainment, including box office results, music, and movie releases, and the world of television. It's free. Go to foxnewsradio.com and look for the podcast button.
You look at the newly expanded, newly improved, newly awesome Empire City Casino, and one word comes to mind. Wow. Is it the new restaurant with an award-winning chef, the new sights and sounds, the new cocktail bar or live entertainment, or the more than 5,300 slots and table games like roulette, craps, and baccarat? Yes, baccarat. I like the sound of that. Baccarat. The new Empire City Casino, exit 2 off the New York State Thruway. It's the dawn of a new empire.
Do you know the American Heart Association's recommendation for a day's sodium consumption is no more than 2,400 milligrams? That's one teaspoon of salt. Since most Americans take in more than they need, Sound Shore Medical Center encourages you to buy fresh, plain frozen, or canned with no salt added vegetables. Cook rice, pasta, hot cereals without adding salt. Read nutrition labels for products with no more than 140 milligrams of sodium per serving. And of course, reduce added salt at the table. What you don't know can hurt you.
Go global on WVOX.com. Call David O'Shaughnessy for more information. 914-636-1460.
WVOX.
We are back. This is Bob Levinson. This is Environmentally Sound. My guest is Daniel Bergner, author of a book called What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Did I get that right, David? Daniel?
Yes, absolutely.
I got it right. Okay, so we're talking about myths about sexuality, and we're going to get to others. But my question was, are men more easily shaken from their fidelity than women? If a guy sees a desirable woman, is he more likely to stray than if a woman sees a desirable man?
And again, if we're talking about desire, the answer is no, that we've been living under this notion, very comforting to men, to me, of course, that men are more naturally, more innately promiscuous.
Right.
No evidence to that effect. In fact, plenty of evidence quite to the contrary. Whether or not in our real world men have more affairs than women, that's something that actually the statistics are ambiguous about. But
really,
again, what I'm writing about in the book is an attempt to get inside the psyche, inside desire.
Okay, so those things are a discussion for another day, another book, perhaps.
Well, I think they're very related, but again, the book is an attempt to look at our psychology. So let me give you a few examples. So Meredith Shivers does fascinating research comparing what women say turns them on versus what their bodies say, using a little device called a plethysmograph, sets up all sorts of contrasts. One, take a very handsome stranger on the one hand, take an equally handsome, trusted, close friend on the other. Women consistently say that the close friend is the bigger turn-on. Their bodies say something else entirely.
Now, let me just cut you off for a second. Let's demystify this device. This device actually measures blood flow to the female genitalia. Is that correct?
Right. So okay. It's an attempt.
So we know what we're talking about.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's an attempt to measure what you would, in men, be measuring when you judge penile swelling.
Right.
For now, the closest we can get to an immediate physical gauge of being turned on
is blood flow. Okay, so now you're saying that when a woman was asked, is the attractive stranger more appealing than the attractive friend or the attractive husband, this machine, this device that measures blood flow, measures increased blood flow more, did you say, with the attractive stranger?
Yeah, there's a strong indication that the attractive stranger is really the biggest turn on, and it fits with the whole series of experiments. We don't have time to go into them here, that are kind of wake up calls that sort of unsettle, again, that old myth of women being, at least by comparison to men, better suited to monogamy. Another myth that's sort of tossed out by Meredith's research, by the research of others, is that when it comes to sex, women are somehow less visual than men. Again, comforting to me as a man, but the reality seems to be quite different.
So if they see a good-looking guy, they're more likely to get turned on than if they see an ordinary guy who might be a great person, but the handsome makes the juices flow.
I'm afraid so.
Well, that's nothing to be afraid of. That's just the fact.
Yeah. I mean, what's curious to me is for how long not only society, but science itself blinded itself to truths about desire and about women and desire. And I'll give you a couple quick examples. The book is 90% about women, and it's women, both scientists and everyday women, who I spent most of the last 8 years with composing the book. But I did spend a week at a primatology center just to see what lessons our close ancestors might teach us. And among rhesus monkeys, which is the very species we sent into orbit as our astronaut doubles in the 60s, scientists were long absolutely certain that males were the aggressors in war and males the initiators, the aggressors in sex. Well, strip away the societal blinders and distortions, and in fact, very emphatically, it's females who are the aggressors in war and the aggressors, the initiators in sex. And amusingly, primatologists have to cycle out, get rid of the male monkeys from their compounds because the females get too bored to have sex with them. So even when you look at the evolutionary lessons, you find that, again, the myths don't stand up.
Okay, so now back to the science. My understanding now, having looked at this material, is that the erogenous, the directly, it's not the erogenous zone because an elbow can be erogenous if it's touched in the right way, but the actual nerve concentration of nerve endings for a woman in her genitalia are comparable to the area in the male penis. Is that so?
Fascinatingly, though, anatomists managed to miss this right up through the 90s. In the last decade, indeed, it's been established, and there's really no longer any argument about it, that yes, right beneath the surface of the skin, the clitoris has extensions that rival the penis for size, that are equally, easily, I should say, reached through the wall of the vagina, that completely sort of debunk the idea that somehow women's organs of pleasure are minimal when compared to men's. And it was that physical comparison that long fed the idea of women's libido somehow being less powerful, less relevant to reproduction than the male sex drive.
Okay, so once and for all, is there a G-spot?
That's a tricky one. I can't give you a one-sentence answer.
Nobody has ever given me a good answer.
Raging debate still. It kind of amazed me.
Even women
me.
Don't know.
It amazed me to follow that debate. And I ended up writing a whole chapter about it because I think it sort of encapsulates just how much, strangely enough, remains mysterious.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, let's go to Viagra for a moment. The pharmaceutical industry is putting a considerable amount of research money into developing a comparable drug for women. Actually, the Viagra and its the other drugs that are for erectile dysfunction were discovered by accident. And what they do, they simply permit the blood vessels to engorge with blood, which is how erection is achieved. It's a different process for women. How would it work? And I mean, you can buy a lubricant, which is mostly the female need. If a woman cannot lubricate properly as she gets older, you got that in a tube. There's nothing in a tube that erects a penis. So what direction is the pharmaceutical industry taking?
Yeah, the notion of a so-called female Viagra is a bit of a misnomer because what we're really talking about is a drug to enhance desire or to create desire. So we're going inside the mind and we're tinkering with neurotransmitters inside the mind. And one of the reasons I spent a chapter telling the story of the pharmaceuticals industry's search for this drug is, one, it gives a fascinating glimpse of how the brain's pathways of lust work. The other is it gives a glimpse into the way we as a culture still, though we seem to be utterly unrestrained when it comes to sex, the way we still view women's desire with a bit of fear. So the following conversations took place within more than one company as results began to come in with experimental drugs. And as the companies worried that their results might be too strong, well, why did they worry this? They worried that the FDA might turn them down for fear that the drugs would unleash or lead us into a world of nymphomaniacs. And while I laughed at this, whenever I ran into this reality, it's also kind of indicative of the trepidation that still exists around women and desire.
I concur, but if it's just the appetite that that they're trying to increase, I mean, men don't. It's totally different. Men don't need a drug to give them a sexual appetite. Either they have it or they don't. The Viagra simply allows for an erection that would not otherwise occur. There's nothing that men go around taking to say, "Oh, I want to be hot now." They just they just are with someone they like, and if they need the boost, they take the pill.
Right, and I'm glad you're asking this follow-up question. So the main market for this drug, and it will be a huge market, estimated around $4 billion a year here in the States, the main market will be women in long-term monogamous relationships. Women going out on their fifth date will not likely be taking this drug. And if you look at studies that have emerged over the last few years, you look at long-term relationships and the trajectory of desire, it's really women who seem to feel a plummeting of desire within monogamous relationships. The drug is there, or will be there, to address that.
Okay, Daniel Bergner, so thank you so much for being with us. Sorry it's so short, but it's very informative, and I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye now. I'd like to thank Daniel Bergner for joining us on Environmentally Sound this morning. I now know, as do all of you, the science behind women's sexuality. Well, some of it anyway. Now, if only I could figure out their wiles and mysterious ways of achieving their goals, I would be happy. I hope somebody writes that book real soon. Okay, we got to get out of here. This is Bob Lubenthal, Environmentally Sound. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
The local station with a national reputation. This is